Blog Talk Radio.
What's up, world, and welcome to Realty Universal Radio, the fastest hour in radio, no doubt about it. I'm Randy Zachary, and this is a show about real estate, about God, about life, about giving back, about being the change in the world that you'd like to see. I'm privileged to bring to you Natalie Mullinex and Realty Universal, a company dedicated to excellence. Realty Universal is a revolution founded on a very simple principle. We believe sellers and buyers should have choices. We have been a pioneer in the menu program system. More on that, of course, a little later. Natalie Mullinex, president and founder of Realty Universal, averaged over $80 million a year in sales prior to stepping back to focus more on building Realty Universal membership network. She's an accomplished speaker, writer, consultant, trainer, and, oh, by the way, mother. She travels worldwide, literally, spreading the gospel, if you will, of Realty Universal. And now, Natalie Mullinex.
Hey, everybody. I'm so happy to be here another week, and I always say that literally. And I hope you all are doing really, really well. And today we're not going to talk about real estate the first half. You know how for those of you that always hear us, or agents and brokers and people that listen constantly, you know we're all about real estate and doing lots and lots of sales, and everybody does lots of sales, and we offer the menu programs, and our affiliates do it, but our heart is always about people, because even in, you know, homes and properties, commercial, residential, we're dealing with people constantly. And one issue, so we're just going to dig right into this today. It's going to be really an interesting show, and I'm really looking forward to our guest and his tons of experience, and I hope he helps you, and also, if not you, somebody you know. You know, lots of issues are behind closed doors. You know, people may come to work or go out in the field, and everything seems honky-dory, and then when they get home, it's a different story. I don't know, with social networking, it seems like too much stuff is getting out there in different ways, but just the stuff that hurts, you know. There's we want to be happy, we want to be productive, and I don't think there's anyone out there that says they don't want to be happy, and it takes work, and when sometimes people think, well, these people are happy, but I'm not happy, and everybody else is happy, but it's only me. And then you find out many people have a lot of different issues going on, and we're always on a mission to help people heal as well, because I think there's just so much of the love and healing that can go on in the world. So those of you that know us know what we're about, and those that don't, I love for you to listen and share and dig in, because it's all about helping each other. So behind closed doors, steps to start breaking the patterns. Jason Nutt today is so experienced. He's LSCSW. I'm going to let him tell you what all this means. LSCSW, experienced behavior health leader and clinician, has his tons of experience helping people break free from addictions, disorders, and many issues that are behind closed doors in families. Knowledge is power, and awareness can be our first step, your first step, everyone's first step in moving forward to live a happier life. Jason is an experienced CEO, COO, and consultant and treatment provider in mental health, substance abuse, domestic violence, post-traumatic stress disorder, geriatric psych, and more, as well as one of his big passions is program design and development. And, you know, when you dig in and you're in the trenches for so many years, who's better than to put together a program and teach and train and see it come to fruition than somebody who's been in the trenches? He's also a 2-time best-selling author on relationship therapy and abuse. And without further ado, I'd like to welcome Jason Nutt. Hey, how are you?
Pretty good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm so glad you were able to take the time. I know your schedule is swamped to come on today.
Yeah, I apologize. It's taken us about a year to next. I apologize. It's been a little insane back and forth I can do that next week. Okay, yeah, I'm going to be in, you know, Netherlands that week. I apologize. I can't do it now. So it's been a little.
Oh, no apology necessary. So. But you've been all over, haven't you? Germany, Netherlands, the U.S.?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, 5 states and 9 countries in the last year. So, yeah, it's been a little crazy.
And you have a little one too, right?
You're
a You're a dad of a 3-year-old. That's a lot. That's fun. That is so much fun. I think that's the younger years are probably the funnest, and then it's a lot of work. Aw, that's so much fun. Well, Jason, tell us. I really want to hear, want our audience to hear, how you got started. What brought you to this point? Because you are really truly giving back and making a difference, and that takes time. You know, sometimes to get to where you're where you are. And if you could give us a little bit about your history.
Well, actually, I was a chef, decided that I was bored with that, didn't really get, I loved to cook, didn't get a lot of enjoyment out of being told what to cook, went into social work, I thought I was going to work in foster care. I worked in foster care and realized that was not really a great setting for me. I was too, emotionally attached to the idea of not hurting kids, so every time I would hear one, it wasn't really a good fit for me. After that, I actually did my master's and went straight into private practice. So I literally went into private practice about 2 months after I got my master's and started moving from there. So.
Congratulations. So you were doing your own practice? And
yes.
Being patient
on
all
two
types of
practices.
Oh, okay.
I was in rural Kansas, so it's one of those. I was lucky and unlucky for the fact that I was not able to specialize at all. So I have friends that they just see one specific disorder or one, they just do marriage counseling for people that have had affairs, or they just see anxiety. I literally saw everything. And it was one of those where I couldn't specialize, and I'm really grateful that I didn't. So help me to go in and the consultant and kind of do a different program designs for different disorders because I've seen most of them.
We have like the different groups and we have like Alcoholics Anonymous, Anonymous and AA and I mean so many groups, codependents. I mean so many groups out there. Do you find that in order for anyone to change, they have to be willing? I mean, I'm sure there's lots of things that are court-ordered versus people wanting to go get help. I mean, where does this – what do you see, basically? Do you find most people are wanting this by the time they get to you or somebody else has forced them to go?
Well, I think it very much depends on that piece. Court-ordered, I did – so I had the two offices as far as private practices, but each of them had 3 court order programs attached to it. Different therapists did different things, but we all kind of overlapped at the same time. What I can say is if someone came in and they were actually at the point where they were seeking the help, most of them were open to the idea that they might need to change. Not necessarily open to change at that point, but open to the idea that they may need to change. A lot of them, though, when they were court-ordered, I had a guy, and he had 9 DUIs. Still did not think that there was an issue with his drinking. Yeah, and so for him, it was not a matter of he's choosing to be there. It's a matter of somebody has a wrong thought about the fact that I drink too much. I just happened to be unlucky 9 times. Yeah, so I think it very much comes down to who's bringing them in. And I've seen the same even on the private practice side, non-court ordered, where whether it was a child or a spouse, where their parent or their grandparent or their husband or wife were the ones that were thinking that they had an issue, and given they may have actually had some type of issue, but being pushed into it is not. It's not where a relationship is generally going to start in a healthy place. So it's one of those.
No.
But yes, it really varies. It's kind of, I'm sure you've seen it in real estate where somebody doesn't want to sell and somebody else, whether it's their spouse or, their parents or whoever does want to sell, they don't make it easy. And I have friends that are builders and real estate agents, and they've told me horror stories of people that just block it, kind of like in Step Brothers, where literally they're blocking the idea of the sale because they don't want it. So.
Right, and it doesn't happen many times. People don't realize how powerful their desires, mesh into this whole picture. you know. Tell us, because there's so many addictions and different things. Do you find that when you were doing foster care, I mean, not foster care, foster counseling, mm-hmm. and it was too hard because you get too close to it, do you find that most of the issues all do start in childhood, or is it can it just be situational? Like, for example, if somebody goes, you know, post-traumatic stress, is that, you know, can be at a later date?
Yeah, and I think it very much varies. To back up, when I did foster care, I actually was more I worked in a group home and an emergency shelter. So it wasn't therapeutic. It was just everyday, day-to-day interacting with the kids. But I will say, when I was in private practice, I did a fair amount of therapy with kids that were in foster care. But to answer your question, though, I would say it does vary. A lot of it does go back to childhood. A lot of it goes back to childhood and the parents. It's one of those that was never something that was easy to explain. That a lot of times it's the parents' behavior that create the child's issue. And that's not to say all the time. My parents were amazing. I swear to, it was like watching Leave It to Beaver to watch my parents together. And I was probably the biggest troublemaker at my entire school. Yeah. And so, I mean, like, it still gets brought up. The times that I'm around people back home in Kansas, there's still stories that get brought up. You know, it's 25 years later since I've graduated. So it's not just that it always is. PTSD, again, that's one of those that there's children that have PTSD, and there's adults. And it's not something that necessarily starts in childhood. I actually have a mild case of PTSD from a really bad truck accident I had in 2012. Before that, it wasn't there at all. And now it's one of those that I've managed it. So it's a time frame of when things pop up. And the other piece is a lot of people look at whether it's addiction or disorders on a mental or behavioral side, that it's something that's always chemical. Like depression can be situational depression. You're going through a divorce. It's sad. That's just normal.
Right.
The death of someone, that's very normal. But there can be a chemical imbalance. Anxiety is usually, if not always, experience-based. So something happened and it created anxiety. So, you know, understanding that. And other times, it's an adjustment thing. People, as much as we talk about, we know that life has changed, nobody likes change. You know, you may like being spontaneous on a vacation, but nobody wants to every day try and shift something about themselves. And so
that makes so much sense.
It's just an adjustment disorder piece. So
that makes so much sense. So a lot of people just want it to stay the same in comfort level. So the adjustment disorder is just not agreeing to accepting day-to-day stuff that changes, basically. Is something like
It can be. Adjustment disorders are usually, I mean, if you were to break it down to the simplest way of looking at it, the way I've explained it to patients is it's something changed in life. You weren't sure how to deal with it or didn't want it, and you're trying to figure out how to accept it. It's very much, I mean, it's an everyday thing. You get fired from a job. If that creates a, you know, clinical level of anxiety or depression, that's
right.
A diagnosable adjustment disorder. So
I see. So the you know, ultimately, when I call it a time to heal, do you think people can work through and heal, or it's kind of like maybe like brushing our teeth, something we have to work on every day, or exercising, eating the right food? Can people heal and then have to continually do either treatments or different ways of life? I mean, and I'm saying this very generally, right? Because I'm assuming it could be very different in different types of disorders or issues.
It does, honestly. It's one of those that almost anything can be worked through. I'm a very big proponent of medication assisting with therapy, but very much against always just handing out a pill. Most things, whether it's anxiety, situational depression, most disorders that I've seen, mood disorders, that type of thing, they can be worked through by talking them out. And so it's a matter of being willing to talk about. Some people, like let's say they go through a divorce. It's one of those – it's a very difficult time. I myself went through a divorce. It was not something that was easy. It probably would have been a lot easier to work through with a little bit of medication. And for some people, that's the level that they need to be at so that they can even process the idea of accepting. I can say as far as –
just to kind of get through it.
The second – yeah, just to get to a point where they can work on stuff. And I've seen it a lot, especially with anxiety. Anxiety is one of those that in the moment, it's really hard to be centered when you're first trying to deal with it. So the medication can help. But learning to depend on it, you don't learn how to actually. But as far as like the second part of your question, as far as following up or going back, like a refresher type thing, I think that varies. But yeah, I think overall we have to remind ourselves of what we believe and the changes we've made and remind ourselves why we've made them. I wrote a book on relationships, and there's times that I stop myself and I'm like, Justin, what are you doing here? This isn't the way that you tend to look at it. In a very stressful situations, I tend to, you know, kind of withdraw versus talking to my wife. Yeah. I don't want to stress her out, you know, so. Well, go ahead.
But that's got to be it's kind of like the shoemaker, right? They say makes, you know, it's kind of got to be amazing when you kind of know, but then you're getting the feelings because you're involved in it. I know it's just like with real estate, selling thousands of properties over the years, literally. I've been in over 32 years, 3 years. And then doing it yourself, you go, wow, now I see how somebody feels. I mean, not that you don't know, you do know, but when you're going through it, it's kind of like we're human, right? We go through different issues. What's your book called? You know, you wrote two books.
I have two books. One is The Good Guy, The Bad Guy, and The Ugly Truth. And that's the relationship self-help book. Not one I actually wrote. I wrote it thinking that I was trying to help other people so that, you know, help women so that the nice guy didn't get hurt. And what I realized was no matter which side you are on, guy, girl, the good guy, the bad guy, the good girl, whatever, we're all facing a lot of the same issues. And so it was writing that actually helped me a lot after my divorce.
Wow.
And then the other one is, it's called Stories of Survivors. It was a project I did. I had founded a domestic violence organization back in Kansas, and it was actually a collection of stories from survivors. I think I talked to about 4,000 or 5,000 different people that were either family members or survivors or actually still in abusive relationships, all different stages, and then put together the project based on the ones that were willing to actually submit their stories. And then that was they originally funded that organization. That organization is now closed, and now the royalties, I just take the check and make it out to a domestic violence organization and send it to them. So.
It's got to be, I guess, at different levels. If someone's going through domestic violence and that's happening at home behind the closed doors, I would imagine there's got to be fear, too, whoever's the one beating up the other one, and power struggles, and they may not know where to turn. I don't know the level of like how much help there is out there if they go to a domestic violence shelter or they just leave and call for help. Is it typically a situation where there are a lot of county help, city help, if somebody has nowhere to go and has to just get out away from that very serious domestic violence?
I think it very much depends on the area. Like I said, I was in rural Kansas, and so the options were not near as good as, like, say, the Kansas City metro area. They have a lot of different organizations, different pieces, different programs that are attached to their community mental health and different organizations that are there. In the more rural areas, they're a lot of times are nothing. They may have something on paper that says, here's how we address it, but you have the domestic violence shelter that's 70 miles away. How do you go to work? How do you take your kids to school?
Right, how do you get there?
So
I mean, how do you get away from the person who's doing it if you're afraid, right? You can't get out.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that ties back to the something you said earlier, which is, you know, a lot of times what we know is a lot easier to accept. And that sounds strange, but the number of women that I've talked to, and men for that matter, that are in abusive relationships, and they'll never leave. No matter what happens,
really?
They're just not going to leave because they just are at a point where a lot of them have had multiple abusive relationships, and they think that's just how relationships are. And that kind of ties in with my first book, and that's because for me it was one of those that I stayed in my marriage. It was a very, very short marriage, but at the same time, I stayed there longer than I should have. And she was abusive, both emotionally and physically. And so it was one of those that I stayed simply because I didn't want to go back to being a single guy at 30 and trying to date and trying to do all these things, have a family. And I think that's where a lot of people are. That's a piece of it. They're isolated away. That control and domination piece of domestic violence is so often there that, you know, they're isolated away from their family. They're isolated away from friends. They're told not to talk about it or that other people don't care. And even when they do talk about it, they may be an exceedingly abusive person to their spouse or partner, their children, whoever. The rest of the world thinks they're an amazing, charismatic person because that's the front they put on to the world. That's the front that they put on in the start of that relationship before they became abusive. They got that person hooked enough before the first time they hit them that the first time they hit them, they didn't leave. You know, and it's just, they kind of go hand in hand most times.
It's horrible. It's horrible. I can imagine being in a situation like that would make one afraid to get in relationships in the future. I would think they would put a wall up and see black and white and just not be willing to take a chance again. It's some deep stuff, right?
I would
it's
say,
some really deep, deep stuff.
Yeah, and I'll say I think it happens. I think there are usually it's almost polar opposites as far as what the response is. Either they never want to date again and they shut down and that's their initial response is, I'm not going to date. I'm not going to talk to anybody. And that's whether it's emotional or physical abuse. You know, it's the emotional part of a physical abuse that is the most damaging to somebody. Thinking that this is the person that's supposed to love me and they're giving me a black eye. That's the psychological piece. But I can say, I know people that are on both sides of them where they go from a very abusive relationship and I know one guy I went to high school with, and I saw one of his Facebook posts a little bit ago, and it's been like 9 years since he's dated. Been on a single date because
really?
He's just done with the idea of dating.
And
he's open to the idea, which means that in theory, I'm okay with someday maybe I'll think about dating someone, which really means, I'm not okay with the idea. But I can say that it's the flip side, too. I got out of an abusive relationship, and it was more so emotional than it was really physical most of the time. But I can say I was the complete opposite. I was so obsessed with the idea of if I had tried harder or I need to do something better or I need to be in a relationship that I went through, 12 or 14, 2 to 6 week relationships, like one right after another, just thinking,
did you really?
I needed to figure out what was going on.
Like a rebound.
And then, it was like rebounding and rebounding and rebounding. I mean, I dated every type of, some of them are amazing people I'm still friends with. So if they hear this, I'm not necessarily talking about them. But I dated every kind of mismatch, never would, not something that is present in my wife, don't ever want again type. So it was one of those, I didn't repeat and date the exact same type of person, but I kept dating people and figuring out which types I didn't like.
Really? Well, that's kind of good. So you were open, though. At least you were open to exploring the opportunity rather than shutting down or, or just going with the next person and then keep making that a serious relationship with when it may not have been a good idea.
I will say I think it was honestly just as damaging, though, because I was looking at it from a I have to try harder standpoint, that it was my fault that my marriage didn't work. And so it was one of those that every time I got out of one, I was thinking, okay, how do I do something better? How do I try even harder? And so
It wasn't your fault. Why do the nice people, all the nice guys always, we always blame ourselves when it's really not our fault. That's something I've noticed a lot on with people that'll take the brunt of it.
I think that comes down to the nice guy or nice girl, a nice person,
stance of it. You know, the fact that from an emotional and empathetic standpoint, we want our partner to be happy. And so if they're not happy and they're hateful or they're abusive or they're argumentative or whatever it may be, we look at what is it we can do to change. I think that honestly, that goes back to kind of what we were talking about in the beginning, though, which there's basic, almost universal truths when it comes to mental health, which is the two biggest things that I saw in private practice were someone coming in that it was an issue that wasn't theirs, that they wanted to know how they could fix it. So they want to know, how do I fix the fact that my husband's having an affair? Well, you don't. You're not doing anything wrong. That's something that they're obviously doing. That no matter what you do, it's not going to change. And then the opposite of that, which is something that is totally within their control, totally something that they're causing, and looking at it saying, well, you know, like if this person did this, if she just did this, then I wouldn't do this. And so I think that when it comes to the nice guy, as far as a unisex term, nice guy, it really comes down to the fact that we want that other person to be happy, and we look at them the same way that they, or that we would hope that they're looking at us, which is we want them to be happy. If we're yelling and angry at them, we're doing it because obviously we feel like we were wronged. Ideally, that would be the flip. And so, and it's not always, you know, abuse is not something that the person is to blame for, but looking at it, like, what can I do different so that I don't get hit or I didn't get yelled at? That's that empathetic piece.
There might be a lot of denial and lack of communication. So I guess if there's abuse, though, typically if there's a man hitting the woman or the woman hitting the man, I know it goes unisex, and it consistently happens and they don't get counseling, aren't the odds that the person's better to get away from that abuse because it's not going to change? I mean, it's going to be a repetitive pattern, or have you actually ever seen a situation where there was a lot of abuse and they got help and it stopped?
I have. But that would be on the batterer side. So for a short time, we actually had a batterer intervention program at one of my offices. And I can say, some of the work that I've done in that field, I've seen, a handful of people, maybe, out of hundreds where they've actually changed. But it also is the fact that for them it works. You know, other than the fact that some of them had gotten arrested, obviously, for domestic violence, for them it works. So it's kind of like the person that had 9 DUIs. For them, it's not a problem. It's not a problem for me. It's a problem for her because she doesn't keep her mouth shut.
Right.
And that's very much the statements that I would hear. You know, of course I did, but what would you have done? Well, it wouldn't have been that. Yeah, like that's not how I would have reacted. But for them, that's, you know, and there's a lot of different hierarchy to it, too. So sitting in a group, you might see someone that says, you know, how they got in a fight with their girlfriend or their wife and, you know, they just punched them, knocked them out. And you literally can see the guys that go across the room talk about, well, you know, I hit her, but it didn't knock her out. Oh, well, I didn't. Yeah. Like it wasn't a close fist. You know, I smacked her, but it was open hand. And then it's pushed. So there's all these different levels as far as how they look at and justify what they're doing is not as bad as the next person, which means they don't need to change. But it goes back to what we were talking about, which is if they're looking at it and they want to change, I've seen it happen. A lot of mine was court ordered, so it was not – they were walking in there of their own volition. It wasn't their own free will. The ones that did come in, though, I've seen them change. But as far as leaving those relationships, I can say when you leave – a lot of times it's the most dangerous, but at the end of the day, if you stay, it's always dangerous. So
that's a good point. That's a really good point. So I guess if a lot of people are in denial too, and they're not going to get change, and that violence, though, to me just shouldn't be. And you see it. Well, when we're talking about different types of things, and this is all behind closed doors because so many people are afraid to say what's really happening. People go to work with bruises or, you know, cut up and who knows, and say that the animal did it, a cat did it, or, you know, I won't go into different things that I've been through my life, but I've seen a lot of situations, and when I was a child, I remember my mother with my father, and he went to work and said a cat did it or something, you know, and I've always been so totally against any type of abuse where I'm more black and white, where it's like, okay, buddy, you know, someone's like really not nice. It's like, okay, put a wall up. That person's abusive, you know, instead of saying, hey, calling somebody on it. I think I'm more of a get out of the situation. I'll never tolerate this. You know, some people are more, I think, calm and giving things time to see where they develop, you know. I would be calm, but I would just nicely say, okay, see you later. You know, if I went on a date or something and somebody was seemed abusive or whatever. But you hear these stories where people are like wonderful, you know, wonderful the first 18 months, and then they change, like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So I don't know if there's any type of, it's like it would be nice if there was a test or something one could do other than checking background records to find out if somebody is that type of person that's not really who they are when you start out and they change later. It's kind of a scary thing to get into.
Oh, yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, I can say, looking at it, I've always been a very black and white person. As far as somebody hits you, somebody does, shoves you, does whatever, that's abuse. Leave. But having been in that situation,
exactly.
You know, my ex-wife tried to stab me and I still didn't leave. Because
you're kidding. Point,
like, there was the connection there. And so, kind of. Yeah, but it's very much what you're talking about, where once that relationship is established, it's a different place. You know, it's not – it's very rare that, you know, a guy or a girl on a first date is going to smack the other one for saying something.
Exactly.
You know, and I've worked with people where – I worked with one lady, and she had dated her husband, let's say almost 5 years, and the wedding night, he gave her a black eye. It was the first time he ever did anything.
That's it. Same.
And it's a matter of, you know, they spend a lot of time. And it goes with that charismatic piece. You build that connection where they're such a good person. It's, you know, there's such a good, deep relationship.
And then they think they are, and then they're not.
It's got to be about me. Yeah, exactly.
You wonder how somebody could snap like that 5 years and then punch her out. You know, that's just like what they would – it's, are they just hiding themselves for all that time? It's just horrible. It's really scary.
Yeah.
It's – I think it's very scary because then by that time the woman's already in love, like you said, and thinks he's Mr. Wonderful, and he's not. And it works both ways.
Yeah.
I mean, unisex. Do you suggest if somebody's experiencing these issues, or maybe with themselves, with extra anxiety or addictions, I mean, do you suggest that people search out and go call the hotlines, or, you know, if they're afraid to tell anybody, or go to some of these anonymous groups, which I don't know how anonymous they really are. I mean, if you run into a neighbor, I'm not sure. I'm just asking, what is a good first step for somebody in moving forward if they're just afraid and they want to get help, whether it's in any type of issue that definitely needs counseling?
Well, I will say I think it very much depends on what that issue is and what their support system is. I can say I have a friend who currently is in group therapy. I knew from a clinical standpoint for a few years, maybe more, that was what was really needed. She wasn't necessarily open to it. She would go back and forth on it, and she was able to reach out to her parents, talk to them, and so it works for her. She had a support system, somebody to talk to, and now she's getting the professional help. Other people, you know, they don't have that, or it is a very, I guess, unaccepting is a good term as far as what their support system's like. They're not necessarily a support system where you go and you say, hey, I'm sad. Like, I'm sad all the time. And they're not going to make fun of you for it. Or they're not going to tell you to suck it up. I've seen people that were alcoholics, and they go and tell somebody they think they need help, and the response is, well, we're all alcoholics. We just deal with it better than you.
So
it's not necessarily supportive. Yeah. So I think AA is not a bad place to start for addiction. You know, the very common misunderstanding is there's group therapy and then there's support groups. Support groups are AA, NA, there's Overeaters Anonymous. There's all different types of – most of the anonymous groups are going to be more supportive, and it's somebody who has that same issue and they're going there.
What's the difference between a support group and a group therapy?
Support group is going to be like the AA where the person who's reading out of the big book or leading the daily devotional or thought, that's somebody that is an alcoholic too. Everybody in that room is an alcoholic. None of them is in the role of a trained professional. I won't say none of them are trained professionals because you know, there's therapists that are alcoholics. There's therapists that are drug addicts. So they may be in an AA or an NA, but they're not in that role. And that's very much one of the tenets of AA is it's not supported from – it's not tied to a therapeutic system, meaning they don't do it. Like I can say my offices, I was more than open to letting AA use them, and they couldn't for the simple fact it was tying them in some way, shape, or form to an actual –
on the
therapeutic
professional
level. Not just exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And then a therapy group is led by a professional. And that's not to say that in therapeutic settings, like inpatient facilities, they don't use AA in, you know, like residential drug treatment, but a therapy group itself would be something that is led by a therapist. So, you know, the groups that I conduct are therapeutic groups. They're not support groups. So that would be the main difference.
That makes sense.
I think
that makes sense.
Either
and
one
group,
is – go ahead. Sorry.
Going to be helpful, right? I mean,
yeah.
I think communication, getting it out, awareness. Awareness seems really, really a huge thing. Sometimes when somebody says, well, I didn't know I had this issue or I didn't know I had this issue. Oh, wow, that makes sense. Now I can take steps to start working through that issue because they have awareness, right? Where, I mean, that's what I've seen in many situations. And I think for people to know that there is hope, to know that there are steps to get better and steps to change things, that's a biggie, right? Because I would think a lot of people feel shut down and powerless. If they're having issues that they feel like they're, I don't know, like even suicide has got to be horrible. I mean, people must feel so shut down. And if they can just talk to one other person or make another call and feel supported. A lot of people I found in life just want to be talked and be heard, you know, in many situations. And somebody to agree or say, hey, I can help you or what about this? Versus like what you just mentioned with somebody with alcohol saying, hey, we're all alcoholics, so deal with it or we deal with it better, you know. That's certainly not going to be supportive. So it's just it's wonderful what you're doing. I've always had such a heart for the self-help side of everything. I went through a lot when I was younger and worked through a lot of issues because a lot of abuse and things, you know, and you work through a lot of things and swear you're not going to be that way for the next generation. You know, there's all these things that go on. But I see so much that seems, you know, these addictions right now with a lot of the people with the heroin addictions you're hearing around the country and a lot of the younger kids taking fentanyl and dying on the first time. I mean, you're hearing horrible stories. I don't know if those addictions are getting started just because the kids are out there with their friends and they're trying this stuff and then they're getting addicted, you know, or... It's just, it's a big, big problem.
Well, I think that's a piece of it. You brought up heroin. Heroin's one of the fastest growing drugs in America at this point, and it has been for, I think like 7 or 8 years. And it's literally, it's the price. It's the people that used to use pain pills. You know, they were taking Oxy or they were taking something else. And it just got so expensive from a financial standpoint that they've turned to heroin. You know, you have millionaires' wives that are housewives in a very rich area, and they're not taking pain pills like they used to. They're not taking Xanax. They're shooting up heroin, and that's just – it's because it's becoming more and more common to the simple fact that, you know, when a pill goes from $30 for a pill to $80 for a pill, that shifts how they're going to use it. But I think it's – in part, it's – that friend piece, but I also think a part, it's a matter of we're exposed to it so much in every setting, whether it's casual
so
conversation, television, radio, video games. I mean, it's everywhere. So it's one of those that I think people look at it like they almost romanticize it in some ways for some people
it's
as
so
a
sad.
Way of escaping.
It's
and they just get addicted. Yeah. And other people, it's friends. Other people, it's just the situation they grow up in. You know, I know some people that
right.
grew up in the inner city and they used drugs when they were younger simply because they hated where they were. They hated what their life was like and the situation they were
right.
in. Now as adults, they're out of that situation and they're not using. Their stopping wasn't a matter of literally moving and changing zip codes. It was a matter of working through the addiction. But the reason that they will explain that they started using it was an escape. And I think that that's, whether it's a happy escape with friends or it's an escape because you hate life, I think that that can be used by almost anybody. So.
No, it's really horrible. I mean, I grew up in the 70s and we did some things. I'm not the heroin, but I mean, did other things that I would never in a million years do now. But you know, but we were. It was kind of a sign of the times. People were out, and I guess it was a matter of who you hang around with and what you're doing. And
mm-hmm.
and then you know, you hear stories where people go, "No, I never would have touched anything," and it's like I would never touch anything now. But I know in the 70s it was more of a wild time. I'm not saying that's an excuse. But it was a lot different than. But now we're seeing these young kids dying constantly, and it's just overdosing on accident because the stuff is it's just horrible. I mean, it's just. But you're right. You say I did hear a few people were talking about because I was asking questions about this heroin epidemic, and a few people were saying that do trainings and stuff. What you just said, that they started out on opioid pills or pain pills. And then they became expensive, and then the heroin so cheap that they could just make it through the day, but even not enjoy it, right? Just to kind of, it's like,
mm-hmm.
it's insane, it's terrible. And there's got to be,
yeah.
I mean, if somebody's out there in that situation, it's best to get in a rehab, isn't it? Or try to get into something to where it's just you're going to get off of it because there's no happy ending. I mean, there's absolutely no way there's a happy ending to that situation.
Yeah, and I can say, you know, looking from the outside, looking from the just a personal perspective, not even the professional side, I would say yes. As far as when there's an addiction, whether it's alcohol or heroin or some kind of, you know, prescription medicine, going somewhere or getting the help, whether it's outpatient, inpatient, long-term, short-term, whatever it may be, getting that help is obviously the best thing. Simply because I've never seen somebody who was a true addict or a true alcoholic that didn't die from it, that didn't die from some complication from it, a wreck, or
right.
at least from an emotional
right.
standpoint, weren't already dead, just completely numb to the world. The problem becomes, obviously, when somebody's in that situation, they may express they want help. It doesn't mean that they necessarily get it. Like I could say,
right.
My mom would probably kill me for saying this, but at the end of my dad's life, he became an alcoholic. He got partially paralyzed from
right.
back surgery, and he actually was really depressed, started drinking. I own my
right.
own companies that did therapy. I was more than happy to pay my guys to see my father with that, you know, the understanding, never talk to me about what you guys talk about, all that, you know, the doctor-patient
right.
confidentiality piece, and he wouldn't do it. So it's literally free for him. He wouldn't do it. And,
right.
Yeah, and he died from alcohol withdrawal. That's literally, I mean,
that's
his body
sorry.
Shut down because it was so addicted to alcohol. And it's one of those that, you know, for him, and, you know, obviously I'm closer to that one. To me, it's you're angry because
right.
he chose that. But I can also look at it and say, because that addiction piece, and that's where a lot of people are at, it wasn't something where creating that change was important enough. And so I think that that's the problem for people seeking help, whether it's
they like the right the numbness or the alcohol is going to be better for yeah, it's not a good
yeah. Well, and it's one of those that, you know, and with addiction you're
it's not better
depending
but I
on the level
that.
You're at yeah. Well, and I was just going to say, you know, your body literally, you know, my dad drank so much at the end of his life that the reason he died is because there was no alcohol in his system. He went to the hospital and he actually
yeah.
that's what he died from, was because your body
from the withdrawal.
Literally becomes completely dependent on it, where it's so used to either having you know, heroin or
right.
pain pills or
right.
what other, you know, Xanax, that type of stuff, alcohol, whatever, in the system that you just can't function without it. It's different than, you know, an addiction like a food addiction or a smoker in a lot of ways, but it's one of those that, yeah, it's one of those that when you're in that situation,
you know,
it's really hard to pull yourself back.
And you know what's really, really sad, and I mean, none of us are perfect. I always say God's the only one perfect. I mean, but what's really sad is the people and the families that get hurt from all this around. You know, a lot of times people are in the situations, in these different, you know, emotional situations or disorders, et cetera, and not willing to get help or not willing to try to find it or maybe not even knowing they need help, in denial. And the emotional damage from the people around trying to help is really hard too, you know, families. And it's just there's so many better ways, right? But to tell people isn't easy.
And it goes back to that. And it goes back to that until you're ready to ask for help. Until you're ready to work on creating a change, they can put you in therapy or inpatient or whatever, and it's not necessarily going to work. So, yeah, whether it's depression or addiction.
I would like to mention a couple things, and then maybe see if we can go over some like meditations or just some ways people can kind of balance each day and in life in general, because life can be. Even, you know, with anything, with just one thing is, you know, what they call normal versus not normal. And I don't like those terms half the time, because it's like, to me, I'm like, we're all unique. We're all miracles. We're all different. And we should really own and hone our own personalities on who we want to be or what we are. I don't mean who we want to be materialistically wise or anything like that. I mean, who we are, you know, because I think it's important that people are able to be themselves. So you get this thing normal versus not normal, and I guess you would call normal being able to just function in society. I don't know. I don't like that term. Is that a classification term that people come up with in the medical field or no?
No. Like, we don't use it in therapy. We can say that, like, people normalize things, but that's to say that people can normalize anything. Like when you're talking about domestic violence, they normalize that everybody's abusive or that this isn't that bad. And so that becomes their new normal.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
If you use drugs every day, if you get abused every day, if you get called names every day, even if it's something positive, if you run 5 miles every day, you normalize that that's what a normal day is. And so we use that term,
right.
But as far as like normal, not normal, we try to avoid that simply because everybody.
That's good.
Everybody's
situation. That's really good, because I think,
you know,
fairness to people, where everybody's different, right? And
yeah.
That's something for people to be able to love themselves. And I always call it, it's time to heal, because there's so many wounded adults walking around and wounded and people hurting children, which is not acceptable at all. You know, it's pretty not. Can you believe we only have about 11 minutes left? It's like it went by fast, didn't it?
Yeah. Sure did. I was a little worried when you said an hour talk, so it went well.
I was like, I knew you'd be awesome. It was like, this went by really, really fast. I wanted to touch on just briefly and then also see about some things that people can do just that actually help generally day to day. What do you think about codependence? Because I've seen where that seems to come up a lot in many, many relationships and many families.
Yeah, I think that it's one of those that if you're in a relationship and whatever the abnormal, to use that term, whatever the variance is, whether it's addiction, whether it's clinical depression, if it's not being treated, if it's not being addressed, I think there is that codependence piece. You know, a lot of times, like if you take an alcoholic, for example, if you're an alcoholic and you're drunk all the time, you're probably not going to get your own alcohol. Somebody else is probably getting it for you. So that person may state, oh, well, you know, I want her or I want him to stop drinking or stop using drugs or stop doing whatever. But the reality is, if you really want it, all you got to do is not go buy them a fifth of Jack Daniels, you know?
Right, right. It's like enabling.
So it's one of those that, yeah. And with domestic violence, I think it's, the same in some cases. It's not necessarily that they're asking for the abuse or that they're responsible for the abuse, but in some ways by not leaving, it's almost the same. And when I say that, it's less a blaming idea as it is saying, if you leave, you're setting a boundary. So it's a lack of boundaries in that case. But it can be almost viewed as codependent. So, but I think that with addiction, it's almost across the board. If there's if people continue to be in their life and they're not holding them accountable, they're not, you know, saying if you don't stop drinking or you don't stop using drugs, a lot of times I see codependence pieces to that.
Right. Or definitely with codependency, can you have a lot of one-sided relationships? The one person's trying to make it better, and the other one's just never. It's never like a rowing. You know, I liken it to rowing a canoe, where it takes two to row a canoe. Well, I mean, one could do it, but a relationship should take two. And you see a lot of relationships that are one-sided. One's getting everything out of it, and the other one's not. Is that codependency?
And I don't know that would necessarily be codependent as far as that. Don't get me wrong. I have seen
hundreds
of those relationships, and you know, I've been in several of the, you know, the ones that I talked about earlier that were very brief, where it was very much I wanted to do everything, and what I realized is, you know, a relationship is, it's never 50-50, but you know, if it's always one person doing everything, you know, 1+1 and 2+0 doesn't equal the same thing when it's a relationship. If it's always one-sided, and a lot of times that's what it is in unhealthy relationships, is it's very one-sided. The person who is the less positive person, it's not even necessarily that they're a bad person, but some one person tends to get more out of the relationship than the other person. You know, they get their time away with their friends, but there's always some kind of drama or reason why you can't go out with your friends. I can spend money on this, but I don't get why you spend so much on that. And I think we're all guilty of it on some level. I can say I go hang out with my buddies almost every Friday night. My wife does not have as many friends or a regular place to go.
Right.
And so she doesn't necessarily see her friends as often. It's not a matter of I don't want her to. It's just a matter of it's more one-sided. And I don't think that that's necessarily unhealthy. If I was, you know, which is a girls' night this Friday, if I was like, well, I'm not giving up my guys' night so that you can have a girls' night, I think that would be very one-sided. But I think that that happens a lot in unhealthy relationships where the less healthy partner gets everything they want and the other person is paying for it. In some ways, that's codependent, but not in the classic definition of codependent where – you know, codependent's more that person is, you know, states that they
you
don't
might get
want
narcissistic,
their husband to
narcissistic
drink,
people,
yeah,
or someone
exactly.
narcissistic,
yeah,
and
like
everything's about them,
yeah.
This has been fantastic, Jason. I am so how do people contact you if you? I mean, I know you're doing a lot right now, so it's are they able to still contact you? I don't know if you're taking on anybody anymore or you're just making recommendations.
As far as therapy right now, I haven't seen anybody in about a year. I can always be contacted through my Facebook page, which is The Good Guy, The Bad Guy, and That Would Be True. That's on Facebook. Trying to think. LinkedIn, you know, obviously we're connected on LinkedIn. Or through my contact form that's on my company website, that's my consulting company. But that's just justinnutt.com.
Justinnutt.com, so that's easy to remember. Okay, justinnutt.com.
Yep.
Okay, perfect.
Yep.
Excellent. So we're down to about 6 minutes, which I hate to do that and cut us off like that. You know, so I wanted to – this has been great, very enlightening, and any people listening, a lot of people, agents and brokers will have a lot of clients and customers, and there's just many issues. It's always important for people to know that you're not alone. You know, many, many people are going through different situations, and life is about change. And the only thing constant really is change, right, and for us to work on it and take baby steps if need be. But there's tons of hope. I think that's really important when people feel like they're there's nowhere to turn. And tons of this is I love it. I'm going to get your books. I'm really interested in that. So right now, what would you? I like to meditate. I pray, exercise. Are there anything you can tell the audience that you would recommend on a daily basis that is good therapy?
Honestly, it's one of those that like I can say that you know I pray personally, but I don't know that that's my most restful or de-stressing time. But for some people it is. Other people it's meditation or, you know, walking around, doing exercise, different things. I think it's a matter of finding something that lets you be with you. Whether that's while you're driving. I know there's people that your day's just so full. I'm actually sitting in my truck now doing this interview because I have other stuff. And I had something right before.
Okay,
that's why
you.
I called you a little bit late. And then
thank you.
I have something, you know, at 3:15, and so I needed to be where I was. But it's one of those that I always find some moment where, whether it's in my truck or it's, you know, I live in the middle of the desert, so I'll go and just wander around in the middle of the desert. When I worked, you know, for the Army, I went out and wandered around on the tank range. And it just was time away.
Did they let you do that?
Time where it was just me.
You could just go play. You could go play on the tank or thing. Huh, that's cool.
They didn't let me
drive
a tank. I was just walking around it, actually. But, yeah, I mean, that's restful.
I
like nature.
I thought maybe
so,
they let you drive it.
No, I would totally have been all about that. But that probably would have been more de-stressing to be able to drive over things in a tank. But,
absolutely.
But I think anybody can find. Yeah, I think anybody can find 5 minutes where – everything, the entire world is shut off, on at least as much as it can be. Like I said, it may be on your drive to work. Turn off the radio. You don't need to hear all the talk radio that goes on. Turn off your iPod. Put down your cell phone. Stop looking at Facebook. And give yourself time because I think that's the most stressful thing for most people. Most people just constantly go to social media looking at it, thinking that, well, I'm going to relax. And the reality is, I think social media is not that much different than reality TV. People either put all the drama on there and ignore anything positive. So they talk about how bad their ex is or how crappy their job is, or they do the complete opposite. And every single post is some happy, cheery thing about how much their life is perfect and their marriage is perfect and their kids are perfect. And I think that we all look at that and just feel like, maybe that truly is what reality is, and so I think it sometimes drags us down. So doing that, I don't think that that's something that's relaxing for anyone. I think just that 5 minutes, even if it's only 5 minutes in an entire day, 5 minutes is just for them, it's just them. Think about what's going on in their day. Think about where they want to be. Think about the positive things they have, and I think that
be
brings
grateful.
You back to normal. Yeah, exactly.
Be grateful,
we can all stress about the negative things
thing.
Going on. Yeah, we can stress about all the negative things going on. But, you know, I think about all the stress and all the drama that I have on a daily basis a lot of the time. And then I can look at my 3-year-old and I'm like, yeah, well, it's not that bad. Yeah, and it's one of those, if you think about the things that there are and you're grateful for in that 5 minutes, it's going to shift how – you either start your day or end your day. So,
I love it. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Hope to maybe we can get you on another time. And I know you're doing big projects and changing the world. It really makes a difference to do what you do. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Maybe next time it won't take a year, but...
Yeah. You'll have another good stuff to tell us too. So, all right, to everybody out there, thanks again. I wish you peace.
Thank you for joining us on Realty Universal Radio. Our hope is that you are enlightened, encouraged, and mobilized to be an agent of change. Realty Universal is on Facebook. Join us there. Follow us also on Twitter at Realty Universal. And for more information, you can go to realtyuniversal.com. Make it a great day.